And good morning, good morning, good morning. It's me again, Jim Groom. And for this hour of DS106 Radio Camp, Summer Camp, I'm here with the inimitable Brian Mathers, who I've been a longtime fan of his visual thinkery work. And he's with us this morning to talk a little bit about some of his ideas and kind of his journey through talking through pictures, if you will, or thinking through pictures. So Brian, welcome.
Thanks, Jim. Big fan also of your good self. And in fact, I think you've got some skin in this game in terms of maybe what we'll talk about today.
If skin in the game means using you to the nth degree, then yes, I have skin in the game.
Well, listen, like I am a curious creative, as I'm sure many of our listeners, our millions of listeners are. You know, a little thought presents itself and I'm thinking, well, where can I take that? And a lot of those thoughts have been, a lot of those early thoughts around visual thinkery were reclaim-oriented thoughts, I guess. But in particular, this idea of aesthetic is something that I didn't really understand until I started doing work for you. So, you know, you would use words like iconic. It's very iconic. That's my best Jim Groom impression there. And you well talk done. About art. Yeah, thank you. You talk about art. You know, I know nothing about art. I know nothing about what makes something iconic. And yet you would give me a fairly loose frame to create stuff in, and I would create within that frame. And it's almost like you were able to keep that conversation going to maybe some of the weaker things sort of got left on the shelf, and some of the stronger ideas that came through we developed. But this idea of how does it make you feel, you know, how whenever you create something visual and you know, you've got you can, and you put it in front of someone's eyeballs, they digest it without even thinking about it. It, you know, they can then think about it, but it goes in first, you know. And that, so that idea of what does it feel like before you get a chance to think about it is something that I have often came back to. And I suppose I'd like to spend some time today sort of maybe fumbling around in some different directions and thinking, you know, just to explore that, the idea of sort of aesthetic and visual language.
It's interesting too, because being an early kind of partaker of your visual magic, one of the things that hit me in Barcelona when you drew the kind of sketch that would become the iconic vision of Reclaim Hosting is the album. And the album, which then gave birth to the fact that we're like an independent record store or even an independent mm-hmm. record label. And then mm-hmm. we kind of have played with just that single vision and that single, I don't know if it's an allegory, analogy, however we're a metaphor. But the thing that was so powerful to me about the record was that it very simply and very kind of concisely captured the principles that Reclaim Hosting wanted to represent. Like, we believed in it. It undergirded this idea of an independent record label, this idea of an independent hosting company that was actually had different principles than, say, Bluehost or GoDaddy or some of the bigger ones. And those were more aligned with the artist, more aligned with the creator, more aligned with building out a sense of who you are and us providing a kind of infrastructure that's affordable, accessible, DIY, etc. And so I saw that record and immediately I was like, that's the Reclaim aesthetic. Like, that is not just the visual beauty. That is a set of principles that we can build upon visually and have for now going on 10 years with you. And so it's amazing to me how you so quickly picked up on so many of the principles undergirding Reclaim and then found that iconic image that we could then build everything else around. I just thought that was magic.
Well, again, this is very interesting because there's two sides to this, isn't it? Because I didn't recognize what it was. You were able to see what it was, and the fact that here is an aesthetic. You know what I mean? All I had done was to absorb what, you know, the conversation that was playing out in front of me, and you know, and sort of played back something that came from my own brain, I guess. And that's what I've tried to bottle in Visual Thinkery. You know, where everything I do is based. It starts in that conversation because I'm a very thin-skinned person anyway, I'm very empathetic, but I'm always just trying to step into whoever I'm working with their shoes and to try to absorb what it is they're trying to communicate or trying to say or trying to be, you know. But it took you to recognize what it was, and then immediately you played it back to me. So it's a bit like a game of tennis, I guess. You know, you played it back to me and you said, well, can you go in different directions, you know? And I remember being on a plane and just sort of going, well, right, okay, this is like solving puzzles, you know. It's as soon as you have an element of the visual language, so if the aesthetic is how you feel, you know, and as you talked about values, you talked about sort of something being a independent and those sort of things, but a record is a, you know, it's a thing. It's a noun. It's an element of that visual language. And then the question is, well, what can I do with that? What can I do with that element of language? You know, because it doesn't take much to think about, well, a record and a record store and a greatest hits album and a, you know what I mean? And you can just start, you know, sort of stepping. And if something's not useful to the aesthetic, you bypass it, you know. And yeah. But if something then becomes useful, say, well, what would that be, you know? And I remember us thinking about mono and stereo, you know, and stereo, yeah. That idea that everything's backed up, and yeah. It's just like, well, lovely, there's a little way to communicate that. There's a, you want stuff in stereo, don't you? You want, you know,
yeah.
And you know, there's limitations to even that little bit of visual language, but it's a lovely little play that as soon as you have something, you know, you can use. And you know, if you think about some of the other visual languages I've explored, with other clients, you know, things like penguins, you know, I'm sure some of our listeners will recognize, exactly. The penguins are created for the GoGN network, and again they are a really flexible visual language. And of course, it's a really good fit. The idea or the concept was there before I came along. As in, they used to, different members of GoGN used to send this squidgy stress toy penguin to each other, you know, and then so it would pop up in Rio de Janeiro, and here's a photograph of our penguin, you know, on Rio's beach, you know, with one of our members, you know what I mean? And then it would be in Australia, you know, or whatever. And so, but this idea of a penguin, you know, it was already there for a reason, you know, and spotting it is half the game, and sort of going, actually, penguins are really good, you know, sort of, who doesn't love penguins? You know, you can sort of get behind it. You don't have a gender problem with penguins, you know what I mean? They're sort of gender friendly, and so from an illustration point of view and a sort of capturing point of view, and from a, they're always up to sort of antics and doing sort of silly stuff, but they're really pretty clever, to be honest, in terms of survival, you know, that idea of survival as sort of researchers spread amongst the globe, you know. It's just, again, you can, once you've got it, you can, it'll run and run, and it's still, you know, still running, and that amazes me, because it started off as one little thing that then struck a chord, and again, that team were able to recognize the power of it and what it could do. And it's done different heavy lifting. Once you've got a visual language, it can do the heavy lifting for you, whether that's communicate stuff or in GoGN's realm, it's more about making stuff feel friendly, I think. You know, they've done some pretty serious sort of research and documents around research, or outputs from that research, that I as a researcher, I'm not, but I would find that pretty intimidating. But yet, sprinkled with penguin dust, you know, suddenly it's more accessible. So it's doing a different thing there, I think, than. Maybe the reclaim. Yeah,
it's two things that I think you really do well with some of the work you're doing, and I'll come back to the second one. But the first one is you have the, you know, the, let's say, the driving metaphor, right, or that mm-hmm. kind of principle that gives birth to a broader aesthetic, whether it's a penguin mm-hmm. or record, and soon enough, you will find yourself. I find, and I mean specifically you, not the royal you, kind of playing with the jokes in there. Like you yeah. immediately start playing on words, you start punning around, and you know, the whole thing not only has a kind of principles behind it, but then it's fun. And I think those are two amazing things. A, how many hosting companies, how many research groups, how many like learning management systems have A, anything akin to an aesthetic, visual sense of beauty or driving principles, and then B, are even remotely like fun and playful and humorous. And I think the marriage of those two things, you know, really takes the work that you've done for, a pretty large swath of the community now to a new level. And I really love the fact that you're able to, and they're sometimes small things, like with Martin Weller's book on metaphors, the name of the boat is Meta, and then the number 4. And I just, you know, it's simple enough. It's not crazy, but it's great. Mm. It's beautiful. It's so playful. It's so right on. And I really like that. And I think that also playfulness underscores, like you were saying with the research, the idea that this is accessible. This is open. Mm. Please come join us. Like, we're not here to scare you with security, servers, climate control, right? Like, this is like, come in and do this and play with us and have fun and learn something. I love the way you were able to kind of walk that line for Reclaim, and it sounds very much like that for GoGN. And I'm wondering, like, how does that play into your idea of, you know, the visual style or the aesthetic?
Yeah, look, thank you for picking up on that. That's very helpful, because I think I realized reasonably early on in the visual thinkery journey that humor was my most powerful weapon. Humor disarms, right? I think I learned it most, not necessarily working for my ed tech clients, because essentially I've got two banks of clients. I've got clients in sort of the education ed tech world, and then I've got a completely separate bank of clients that are around sort of environmental policy and sort of plastic pollution and or preventing plastic pollution. So, you know, people like Greenpeace, Friends of the Earth, there's loads of little NGOs based in Brussels that I've done a whole bunch of work with. And the idea of using dark humor, you know, so whenever you're talking about an existential crisis, you know, as we face, you know, in the world today, you know, how do you reach people? As in, are you going to, do you have to use shock tactics? Do you have to, so for example, plastic pollution, do you have to, is it another picture of a turtle with a plastic around its neck? You know what I mean? Which is hard to look at, but, you know, it's trying to communicate this sort of problem. And I think I realized that the power of cartoons and that humor element that can be, not just sort of not slapstick humor, but dark humor, and sort of just going, really, you know, can you believe this? You know, can you? And leaning into that side has been really effective, because it has the, in fact, I'd say, probably say dark humor has a stronger power to it in terms of disarming or grabbing the attention of someone, you know, who's looking at it. It's certainly not forcing them to close their arms. It's the opposite of that, you know. So I've been amazed at how that can be used. But again, a lot of the humor that I tend to pick up on, a lot of it is coming from me, or things that that you know, that I find humorous, you know what I mean? But most of it's rooted back in that conversation I'm having with the client. You know, it's their world that I'm spotting. Because I'm an outsider, I'm able to sort of spot something that's absurd, or a situation or a part of a story that's absurd. Whenever I play the ideas in front of the client, they are gravitated generally towards those more absurd, you know, those little bits of playfulness. You know, there's another element to it as well, which is part of it is just I've drawn. You know, we've used a Jaws metaphor. There's a boat on top. You know, I've sort of looked at various different images and you know, to do with the movie, and I've drawn a boat, and I'm going, well, what would this be called? And the boat tells you what it should be called. You know what I mean? The boat answers right back. You know, or I've got a person in danger of the shark. You know, they're on a Lilo. Well, of course they're on a laptop. So, you know, it starts telling you, you know, because you have this visual language, or the scene's already set, and it starts telling you the bits that need to be there, you know? So, it's just funny how it evolves.
So it's interesting too, because I mean, you, Brian, have in many ways developed an aesthetic. Like, I can look at art and say, oh, this is Brian Mather's art. Although I have to be honest with you, and this might be a good kind of, you know, frame. I didn't realize you did the art for OER 20, was it 4? For the most recent, like, and that was a really great piece, but I was like, yeah. Oh, wait, this is Brian Mather's art? I didn't recognize it. And was that for you a conscious departure from your aesthetic? Or are you just, is it part of your experimentation? Like, or did it just, it called for something totally different? Like, there was no sense of cartoon in that. So I'm just wondering what your take on that is.
So, well, there's, if you look carefully, there's definitely cartoon in there. There's definitely cartoon in there. But yeah, that I loved how that came out, actually. Sometimes you got to do a bit more digging.
Maybe we should describe it for the listeners, because I didn't do a good job of describing it. So what is the piece we're talking about for OER 24 before we go too deep into it?
Well, so there's the lettering themselves. So it's more of a brand aesthetic, isn't it? You know, because, and I've done this at successive OERs where I've met, again, had a conversation with those people that are chairing and responsible for the themes. Usually Maren Deepwell is involved, or, you know, has been involved in there too. And so she's sort of guiding the process, because, you know, guiding academics is a tricky business at the best of times. And I'm hunting for clues. And I'm playing a game that my participants don't necessarily see as a game, you know what I mean? They don't, sometimes if they're new to it or new to how I work and my process, they're going, well, what's this about? What's this conversation about? What are we doing here? But what I'm doing is I'm poking, and I'm trying to find an angle. I'm trying to find a clue that I can work with. I'm trying to find, you know, and so for OER 24, which is based in Cork City, one of the things that evolved was the sort of the Book of Kells, the you know, Ireland being a sort of an ancient you know, source of place of learning, I guess, you know, the time taken to sort of to create something beautiful that held the knowledge, you know. And so I what I tried to do, and I didn't know whether it was going to work, and I actually came up with I think two or three different ideas, but was to try to think, well, what would a modern version of that be, as in, or, and a Brian version? Because I do things in my style, because I've only got one style, you know, it's just me, you know. So I was trying to sort of just absorb the beauty of some of those sort of ancient texts, but yet live in a digital world, I guess. And so I sort of spotted some of these sort of little small dots, almost like, and you find them in different ancient civilizations. You find them obviously you know, in First Nation Australian, you know, culture, you'll find it in sort of Tinga Tinga art in East Africa as well. But these are almost like stipple, you know, sort of dot effect. And so I created OER 24 with that, and I don't know, it just really resonated with people, and it really worked. And better than that, I went to OER. I really enjoyed OER 24, but they had big screens everywhere with it on. You know, it's one thing creating it; it's another thing displaying it. And they had it on everything. You know, which was beautiful, because RGB wise, you know, you can use punchy colors when you're drawing on an iPad, and it really popped. You know, yeah. So I was really pleased with how it evolved, but again, rooted in a conversation. But the question is, Jim, is it art?
Is it art? But is it art, Brian? But I think it actually, you know, one of the things I'm realizing just asking that question is, I didn't see it, only saw it on the laptop because I wasn't at OER 24 in person. So I didn't get to see that. And I didn't get the subtlety of it until I, you know, until I was like, oh, that's Brian's art. And then I gave it a second look and I'm like, oh, I can see some of that. But for me, the subtlety of it and the fact that I almost felt like you were trying on a, you know, a completely different style, or like going where you needed to go culturally, right? With the idea of illumination and the Book of Kells and all of that. But it raises a bigger question, I think, and this is maybe for you more individually as an artist, is, you know, part of your aesthetic, you know, obviously is rooted in cartoons and is rooted in humor. And then you've kind of married those two for your own project with the work you're doing around a kind of a history, if you will, through zines of Ireland. Yeah. And I think, how does the kind of aesthetic now start to marry to the politic of, you know, what's going on and where we do? Because I don't think, you know, as much, and this is a big philosophical, this is an artistic question, like, can you divorce an aesthetic from a politic, right? Reclaim has a politic, right? We don't want to be like the big corporate sellouts. We don't want to play big ed tech. We want people to feel like they have a voice. We want people to feel like there's a person behind it. Like, that's a politic, and that's a politic we're trading on. And I wonder, have you, through your own work as a visual artist, sometimes, you know, a gun for hire, found your own aesthetic and your own politic through your work?
Yeah, well, thank you for asking that. Yeah, I think there's a commonality here. And I will tell you the cartoonist's greatest trick, Jim. I'll tell you. The cartoonist's greatest trick is that a wobbly line, if you draw something with a wobbly line, it is more human than a very straight computer-created line, okay? And so when you draw a cartoon and have people in the cartoon, it feels human. If it feels human, it feels genuine. Right, and feels honest, and yeah, I think that represents me. You know, I'm trying to create things that are genuine. You know what I mean? I don't really do any corporate work. I'm not really, you know, working for the man. I'm trying to take conversation with real people and turn it into things that reflect, turn it into art that reflects those people and what they're trying to say. So that element of you know, being genuine, and that element of honesty, I think is so powerful especially in an AI world or in a computery world. But humor, the humor is also human, you know? So building humor into art just makes things again feel more human. So I think that's the sort of a central strand. So then trying to deconstruct my Irish past or my Ulster past. Again, I found trying to use cartoons and humor to do that. And for me to be honest with myself and allow others to see some of my thinking, I found it incredibly powerful. Funny enough, though, it seems to get harder. Every zine I do gets harder. I don't know if I'm trying to set the bar higher or whether I'm getting slower or whatever, I'm not quite sure. But But I definitely get a chance to be me and to try to say stuff in a way that, you know, that some of, I would just love to have an impact in Ireland, you know, as someone who's sort of was born in the Troubles and thinks very differently now than maybe they would have done, you know, when I was growing up. And so being able to sort of deconstruct that and be able to jump back, cartoons allow you to do that. I can represent myself as a boy or whatever else, thinking a thought, finding something funny or finding something absurd very easily in a cartoon. I don't know a better way of doing that, you know. And yet I'm able to keep it completely personal so that someone else can look at it and go and identify or choose not to.
Yeah.
You know, they can see meaning or choose not to, you know, but there's no threat there. I'm not telling them what to think. I'm just talking about stuff that is meaningful to me. So that has been another whole journey really that has amazed me.
Well, honesty and humor could almost be like a, you know, a life philosophy, right? Be honest, but funny, right? Like that would be a wonderful life philosophy to, if you one could adopt it as much as possible. But yeah, it sounds like
a great gentleman's barbers, doesn't it? Yeah. Honesty and humor, gentleman's barbers. I maybe need to set that up, having a background in hairstyles as I do.
But I also like the point you made, and one that I really didn't make and should have is, you know, you do keep it as a, because it is such a gigantic topic and, you know, it comes from so many different points of view, and it is potentially, a point of contention, right? That you're acknowledging and approaching it from your own journey through it, you do seemingly most of your art. And I think that's interesting because, you know, part of, you know, and I don't know, you know, because having been a kind of student of literature and maybe not to the same degree as visual art, like the term of aesthetic was almost like the term of art. Like, is it art? Like, what exactly is an aesthetic again? Like, it's one of those terms that it took me, you know, most of my life to come to terms with. Like, but I understand, okay, it's visual beauty, but it's not just that. It's also some sort of principled idea that an artist kind of represents, so it can offset the beauty. And I love it because it's one of those multifaceted concepts, you know, that undergirds like a whole creative way of thinking. That is as a word, it's like you could almost unpack it over a lifetime. And I think that's why the fact that, you know, your story in itself is, I'm continue to be a gigantic fan and just truly, how would I say, just, you know, not mesmerized, that's the wrong word, but fascinated is the wrong word. It's too kind of general, but like astonished might be right. I don't know what the right word exactly is. I got to figure that out. But the fact that, you know, at a certain point, being a programmer saying, you know what, done with that, I'm going to try my hand at this whole, you know, creative, you know, cartoon thing, and the success you've had, I just find that really admirable. I think maybe that's the term I'm looking for, the admiration I have at your ability to do that.
Well, look, it's admirable if that's the way you tell the story, but that's not how it was, you know. You know, I've only ever done a succession of small experiments, and switching careers. As in, I keep pinching myself, going, "Oh yeah, I used to run a software company." You know, I used to do all sorts of stuff in a completely different world, and it seems like a completely different Brian. But I never really made the conscious choice to be a cartoonist. You know, I started drawing on an iPad in order to do a thing, you know, in order to say a thing in a corporate world. And one thing led to another, and, you know, people started asking me to do stuff for them, and they were terrible, you know, but it was definitely small steps, because I'm not brave enough to, and I don't think I've ever had visions like that. I remember as a young man, whenever we were, you know, starting our first company, we went to this entrepreneurship course, and it was apparently, it was very important that we all had 10-year visions. And I was very certain that I didn't have anything like a 10-year vision. As in, it was me and three other guys had started this little web company, like back before the dot-com crash, you know. And but I just didn't have a vision, because I just don't think that way. You know, I just see little, small, curious wonderments. And I just sort of go from one of those that then opens another couple of different rabbit holes that, you know, I think people in this audience will know what I'm talking about there, because I've seen very similar behavior. And especially anybody who enjoys a remix, you know, is oriented in that way, where a creative opportunity presents itself and they have to take it, you know.
Yeah.
And so that's the journey, really, as in how it looks like from 30,000 feet, you know, and maybe it looks more impressive than it is, but
yeah. It's worth talking about the remixer, and I do want to come back to that. But before we do, you reminded me of one of the things that, you know, this idea of vision and maybe not having a 10-year vision or not having a grand historical narrative that's driving your work. I've been reading a Belarus author who won the Nobel Prize. I don't know if it was 2015 or 17. Her name is Svetlana Alexievich. I think I'm pronouncing that right, but forgive me if I'm not. Anyway, I'm reading a story by her, or actually a narrative by her. It's kind of documentarian, where she has a whole bunch of people tell their stories of what it was like in the Afghanistan war. So when the Russians went to Afghanistan. And so that's all to tell you what she wrote. But what was interesting to me is, for the first time, I've read a bunch of her books. For the first time in her books, she spent a little time explaining her vision, right? And it was super interesting to me, because I've read many of her books and she never says anything about like why she's doing this or how she's doing this. A lot of other pundits do, but she doesn't. But in this book, she says, my idea is to try and resist the grand historical narratives and capture the people telling the story in the moment that will be forgotten, you know, and tell the details about what's was in their kitchen, or what they were eating, or what they smelled, or all of these other details that will get lost in the grand historical narratives. And she talks about it as small histories, as individual histories, which kind of is an interesting way to maybe think about the Ulster Project, but also maybe to think about some of the broader ways that, you know, communities now can and should start to tell their stories and start to think about there are the grand narrative historical visions that will be told whether we like it or not, but our small place in it, and you know how we saw it and how we experienced it and what it meant to us may weave together a whole bunch of smaller histories that tell a different, grander history. And I'm fascinated by her attempt at that. And it reminds me a lot of what you're talking about. Reminds me a little bit of kind of moving away from that.
Well, look, I that makes complete sense to me. You know, in that, and again, back to the root of the things that I do is conversation. You know, because conversation is almost like this the smallest common denominator. You know what I mean? In history, I guess. You know, you know, it's maybe one way to look at it, but finding, you know, the nuggets are hidden in the grubby detail.
Yeah.
You know, that has been clear to me for many years. Certainly in my process, that's clear. As in, it's the form of words that someone chooses to use without thinking, as in a little metaphor that just sort of pops into, and you're like, aha. That's the angle. That's the angle I'm looking for here. It's because it's telling a story. You know, it's telling a story that comes from the source. You know, because who can possibly? I've also, you know, how do you stand on a plinth and proclaim yourself the authority to sort of say, here is how it is? You know what I mean? I don't know how to do that. You know, I didn't go to the right school that allows me to do that. You know, I can only tell you what it looks like from where I'm standing. you know, and also I found that where other people are standing, they see all sorts of other things that are so interesting. So it really bothers me in things like just meetings. So, you know, whenever you don't get the viewpoint from a person who feels they, for whatever reason, they can't contribute or isn't allowed to contribute, or, you know what I mean? Or it's not a level playing field, or for, you know, whatever. That just feels so unfair to me because everybody sees different stuff. Everybody thinks different stuff. And it's just those little grubby, you know, in the grubby dust, that's where the gems are.
Yeah. And it's funny because that's how this Belarus author does it. It's all through conversations and the way she weaves them together as a broader idea. And so to the point of your kind of style, and you're hearing all these different things and being able to bring them out and then kind of, you know, weave in those points that people didn't make. You've also gone beyond that and made a machine where other people can jump in and actually add their two bits and not have to worry about being, you know, not being able to talk about it or being silenced in a meeting or not having that place. Like, you've created this really cool tool called the Remixer, right?
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about the creation of the Remixer and why you did it and, you know, what it's, I know you're excited about it now, so I'd love to hear why you're excited about it.
Well, I've been working on the Remixer for a number of years. And it's the same sort of thing where, you know, one day I discover what SVGs are, you know, a document describing vectors, you know, and then my web sort of year 2000 knowledge of the web, you know, sort of goes, well, hold on a minute. If you twiddle parts of that document, the SVG changes. Oh, that's interesting. You know what I mean? And again, a series of very small steps. And also then you always need a reason to create stuff, or at least I do, you know? So yeah, I remember being, I was at some sort of a retreat with people like Greenpeace and you know, environmental organizations that were they're sort of thinking about policy, but also they had some artists along, and I found myself there, and it was brilliant. But I was like, well, hey, you know, there's a campaign and we could use this, we could remix, you know, sort of business cards, and there would be a thing, you know, suddenly I've got a reason to turn some lines of code that I'd mucked around with into a, well, if that person was able to remix their own business card and print it, oh, that would be really interesting. And I found myself sort of in a space where people were like, this seems different from conversations we've had when it comes to thinking about campaigns. And so one thing led to another, and every enhancement I made to this machine, I guess, is where more people started dabbling with it. Its root is in that same curiosity, or that same realization that the way I see the world is not how anybody else sees the world. So whenever I see the opportunity to remix something, everybody else sees different opportunities to remix something, which is, so one of the remixers that I'll share, or that we can put in the notes of this radio broadcast, is a little cartoon that people can remix the speech bubble. And it's funny, I just sort of thought, oh, one, you assume that people are like yourself, so I assume everybody wants to remix, and that's not true. I think, in fact, probably the majority of people, when presented with an opportunity to remix something, actually sort of won't, for whatever reason. I don't really know why, you know, whether they don't think that that's fun, or whether that's putting them on the spot, or whether they don't get enjoyment from that, I don't know. But there's certainly a slice of people who will see something and jump right in, you know. And so some of the remixers that have worked best, you know, things that have been used for conferences, so things like a remixable postcard, have been simple enough to allow people to just, you know, upload a photo, type a few a sentence even, and publish. And of course, everybody being able to see what everyone else is remixing is the real gold of it, where a gallery just sort of starts to emerge of different people's inputs. And that, I don't know why that gives me so much joy, but it really does, because I don't know, there's something very human about that, and realizing that everybody's got a different angle, you know, and therefore everybody's remix is different. So I guess that's the background to the remix machine, but it just keeps going. That's the thing.
It's funny to me the way that your remixer captures that sense, like you said, of, you know, make it human or honest, and mm-hmm. make it fun. And I think one of the things I remember about our conference together, OER by Domains 21, is remixer was employed to allow people to, because it was a fully online conference, we were deep into COVID, and the remixer allowed people to create their own, essentially, conference name tags. You didn't really need a conference name tag because it was an online conference, but almost everyone created it because it was a fun, unique way for them to introduce themselves to the rest of the people in the conference, and it worked. And it was a really kind of, I started to associate the people who would come to that and who would introduce themselves with their name tag, kind of like you would at a conference that was physical. And it was a really beautiful trick to kind of take some of what we've expected in physical conferences, but give it a new twist and a fun twist, and still say, like, it's important for you to be there. It's important for you to introduce yourself and to kind of give yourself a sense of what it is. I really love that piece of it.
Yeah, that worked so well, didn't it? And again, we seemed like a good idea at the time, so we created it. But, you know, like most projects that involve Jim Groom and Brian Mathers and Maren Deepwell, you know, we afterwards were like, oh yeah, yeah, that had a different angle to it. You know, so again, I found myself looking at how people presented themselves and thought, oh, there would be an interesting person to talk to. You know, there's a person that actually, I need to make sure that I connect with them. Or, you know, and in a way that if you give me a delegate list, you know, as conferences tend to do, it's just like, well, I've got nothing to go on here. I don't know, you know, I've just got a name and an institution.
Exactly.
You know, and so there was a very functional angle there of allowing people to introduce them. Also, you know, people sort of saying, I am here, you know, I am, because also with that conference, because it was all online, as in people could check out, you know, but somehow by creating something, you were saying, I'm now officially part of this conference, you know?
Yeah.
And therefore I guess that people were probably more engaged as a result, you know, by I don't know how many percent, you know, maybe it's only 1% or whatever, but definitely I think there's an impact. So this is what happens with all sort of creative projects, is afterwards you're like, oh yeah, it had that effect too, and that was quite interesting. And, you know, yeah,
well, the investment there is definitely telling, like the idea that people invested a little bit of time and as a result it paid off. So I mean, that's great. And look, this has been an amazing conversation. We're coming to the end of our hour, Brian. So I just wanted to get a sense, is there any points about, because I know I hijacked the conference again and again around Belarusian literature and the rest. So is there any points you wanted to make that I might have missed?
No, I don't think so. I think we've done very well. I think I'll be keen to see if anyone remixes my little cartoon on the remix machine. Anyone who's listening, and as you look, there's millions of listeners, I'm sure.
Nobody's listening. That's the rule of DS16 Radio. Nobody's listening.
Okay, so the gallery is just going to be, you know, me remixing my own cartoon.
You know. But is it art? All alone. if art happens in a vacuum, is it still art?
Is it still art? Well, that's a topic for another day, isn't it, Jim?
It is. Well, Brian, thank you so much. You're so generous with your time and with your thoughts, and I really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure. I very much enjoyed the conversation. Thanks, Jim.
All right. You too, Brian. Take care.
Cheers.